Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Actual Fraud Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 1, 2016, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Husky International Electronics, Inc. v. Ritz. Between 2003 and 2007, Husky International Electronics sold and delivered electronic device components worth more than $160,000 to Chrysalis Manufacturing Corp. Chrysalis, then under the financial control of Daniel Ritz, failed to pay for the goods, and Ritz encouraged the transfer of funds from Chrysalis to various other companies. Ritz held substantial ownership stakes in these companies, which had not given reasonably equivalent value in exchange for the Chrysalis funds. In May 2009, Husky sued Ritz in federal district court, seeking to hold him personally liable for Chrysalis' debt. Ritz filed a voluntary Chapter 7 bankruptcy petition, and Husky then filed a complaint in the bankruptcy court alleging actual fraud to preclude a discharge of Ritz's debts. The bankruptcy court ruled that Husky had failed to prove actual fraud, however, and the district court affirmed that decision. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit likewise affirmed the lower court judgments, finding no record evidence of a false representation by the debtor, which the Fifth Circuit deemed a necessary predicate to establish actual fraud. The question now before the Supreme Court is whether the actual fraud bar to discharge under Section 523A2A of the Bankruptcy Code applies only when the debtor has made a false representation, or whether the bar also applies when the debtor has deliberately obtained money through a fraudulent transfer scheme that was actually intended to cheat a creditor. To discuss the case, we have Zvi Rosen, who is a visiting scholar at Hofstra University Maurice A. Dean School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Rosen.
This case presents a simple question, and it serves surrounded in a swirl of bankruptcy code verbiage. But in a nutshell, the bankruptcy code says that debts that result from actual fraud are not dischargeable. Does this statement that debt that results from actual fraud not dischargeable include a requirement of a fraudulent misrepresentation in order to accomplish this fraud? So the code section at issue is Title 11, which is a bankruptcy code. Every title section that I talk about is going to be from there. It says that a discharge under this title, being a bankruptcy code, does not discharge an individual debtor from any debt for money, property, services, or extension, renewal, or refinancing of credit. And here's the key part: to the extent obtained by false pretenses, a false representation, or actual fraud. And as I said, the question is whether this requirement that whether the word obtained by actual fraud includes this requirement of misrepresentation. So there are two other code sections to be aware of because they're interplaying with this section, where it's A4, which says a discharge under title does not discharge an individual debtor for fraud or defalcation while acting in a fiduciary capacity. And A6, a discharge under title does not discharge an individual debtor for willful and malicious injury to the debtor. So let's go back to the beginning and talk about the facts a little bit. Daniel Lee Ritz was at all times the partial owner of Chrysalis Manufacturing. Chrysalis was an electronics company, and they made a number of purchases from Husky International Electronics between 2003 and 2007. So Husky delivered the goods. Chrysalis never paid for them. Chrysalis owes Husky $163,999.38. So this is all agreed to. During this time, Ritz made a number of transfers to a number of entities that he fully or partially controlled from Chrysalis during this time, totaling over $1 million. And everyone agrees these transfers were made. Ritz says that these transfers were repayment of intercompany loans from these other companies to keep Chrysalis afloat. So Chrysalis filed for a corporate Chapter 7 bankruptcy in 2008, scheduling a little over $5 million in debt. The Chapter 7 trustee for Chrysalis reported that Chrysalis has no assets, and the case was closed. But Chapter 7 trustee did not launch any adversary proceedings against anyone to try to recover money for creditors of Chrysalis. So the next year, in May 2009, Husky sued Ritz in federal district court. And Husky's allegation is effectively a double veil piercing. They argue that Ritz's transfer of money from Chrysalis two other entities that he controlled was a fraudulent conveyance, and they are arguing that a veil should be pierced and Ritz himself should be personally liable. Shortly after this case was brought in district court, Ritz filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy, and Husky refiled their lawsuit as an adversary proceeding in Ritz's bankruptcy, arguing not only that Ritz owed them that money, but that Ritz's debt to them was not dischargeable under Section 523A2A, A4, and A6, which are the code sections that I talked about a minute or two ago. So this is argued, and in 2011, the bankruptcy court reached a decision. The bankruptcy court said that Ritz had orchestrated the transfers, and the transfers were not made for a reasonably equivalent value. In other words, the court found that Chrysalis did not receive what is called reasonably equivalent value, which is a term of art, but it generally means that the transfers were at least constructively fraudulent. The court also found that Ritz was not a credible witness and that he had made contradictory statements and generally been evasive on the stand. Generally speaking, the court seems to find that Ritz had likely moved the money out of a banker Chrysalis into his own entities and that Chrysalis had not received proper value for it. However, the court found the debt was nonetheless dischargeable. The court found that it was not a fraud defalcation by a fiduciary, and the court found that it was not a willful malicious injury. Willful malicious injury comes up a fair bit, but in a nutshell, it generally refers to actions resulting from intentional torts that go above and beyond simple business torts. So a breach of contract is not going to be an example of willful malicious injury. A classic example of something that would be a debt for willful malicious injury is, say, a debt resulting from an assault or something like that. But what's a key part about the bankruptcy court decision is that the court found Section A2A was not applicable to Ritz's conduct. The court found that Ritz had never made any fraudulent misrepresentations to Husky. In fact, had only spoken to them once. And the court found that it was a requirement of Texas law and thus Section 523A2A that a fraudulent misrepresentation be made to the creditor. So Husky appealed on state law grounds and as well as Sections A2A of actual fraud and A6 for willful malicious conduct. The court found that the requirement of making actual fraudulent misrepresentation was part of A2A, regardless of what Texas law said, and also found that Section A6 was not applicable. The Fifth Circuit affirmed on essentially the same grounds, and the Fifth Circuit held if a debt was not dischargeable under a grant of Section 523A2A and Section A6. So the Fifth Circuit raised a question that also would come up before the Supreme Court, which is why didn't the trustee argue Section 727A? Because Ritz had filed a bankruptcy petition under Chapter 7, and his discharge is governed by Section 727A. 727A states that a court shall grant a discharge of a debtor unless a debtor with intent to hinder, delay, or defraud a creditor or officer of the estate, charge of custody of the estate, has transferred property of a debtor within 1 year before filing or property of the estate after filing. And a lot of people are saying this says that if you make a fraudulent transfer, then you don't get a discharge. However, this section is actually not applicable to this case because none of this was property of Ritz that he transferred away from the estate. The accusation is that Chrysalis had this money transferred away, and you couldn't bring action under 727 because a corporation can't get a discharge under Chapter 7 anyway. But because this wasn't property of Ritz's that was transferred away, there wouldn't be any way to find that Ritz couldn't have a discharge under 727A. The code section just doesn't fit. In order to find Ritz's debt to Husky non-dischargeable, it would have to be Section 523A. So, and this came up before the Supreme Court, too, asking why they didn't allege 727, which might be an oversight in briefing, but 727 would not really be applicable to this case. So this goes before the Supreme Court. So at the Supreme Court, we've shed all the other causes of action, and we are now at a fairly simple grammatical question, which is, does Section 523A2A, and to recap, Section 523A2A states that a discharge under this title of a bankruptcy code does not discharge an individual debtor from any debt for money, property, services, or an extension, renewal, or refinancing of credit to the extent that that debt was obtained by false pretenses, a false representation, or actual fraud. So is there a requirement of making a false representation for actual fraud? And the argument for Husky is really quite simple. If you require a false representation to find actual fraud, then you're effectively reading actual fraud out of a bankruptcy code, because A2A says either false pretenses, a false representation, or actual fraud. The actual fraud was added in 1978 when they revised bankruptcy law into bankruptcy code. Before, it had just been false pretenses and false representation. Now, the Supreme Court has pretty much said, and the Fifth Circuit has said explicitly, that what was going on in 1978 was effectively a codification of pre-existing precedent, and that actual fraud still requires a false representation, because that was what was required for actual fraud at common law in 1978. So in a nutshell, the argument for the plaintiffs is that you're reading or actual fraud, which was a specific amendment made by Congress to the bankruptcy law, out of a bankruptcy code by saying a false representation is required, because there's a separate section for false representation. The argument for writs is essentially that you read actual fraud as it meant at the time the section was enacted in 1978, and actual fraud requires a false misrepresentation. The oral argument was interesting in that both sides sort of had trouble with this one. The obvious problem that writs had is there is a clear grammatical argument to be made here regarding actual fraud meaning something that's not constrained by false representation, and that you're effectively reading it out by reading it this way. And so writs had a problem with that. But on the flip side, there is clear precedent in terms of a reading of actual fraud that incorporates a false representation. There's also a canon of construction for a bankruptcy code that states that you're supposed to read the exceptions to the discharge in a way that is most forgiving to the debtor. The idea is that we only want to be accepting debts from discharge if they're obviously not dischargeable. If it's a marginal case, then it's going to be accepted from discharge. And we'll see what happens. It's one of those issues where the court could go either way. There's a lot of swirl in code sections, and we'll see what happens.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.